My guest today is Joe Paiva, the International Trade Administration within the Department of Commerce, Chief Information Officer. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
International Trade Administration, it sounds like we know what you do just by the name, but let's just talk real briefly. Let's start at the beginning. What's the mission of the ITA?
Sure. The mission of the ITA is to help U.S. workers and companies compete and win in the global market. We do this through creating an environment in which U.S. companies can trade fairly on an equal footing with other countries.
Now, you guys are within the Commerce Department. Commerce has a huge mission, so you play a role. Obviously, you work with other agencies as well within Commerce, other bureaus. Talk a little bit about your role as the CIO. How do you support ITA's mission?
So there are really four major thrusts of my effort here at the ITA. The first and the foremost is just to make life easier for the people in the field doing the work as they do it today. So if you think about where the ITA is in the market, we have a set of services that we've been providing for over 30 years that are absolutely critical and necessary to the companies that use them. So I just have to make it easier for people to continue to provide those services the way we do now. But the second part of my job is, as the CIO, I am the chief enterprise architect for the ITA, which means I have to facilitate the discussions amongst all of my teammates and all the business units to help identify what do our future business processes look like. Where are we 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now? And if you take a look at global commerce in general, what you can't help but to realize is that U.S. exports are going to go up no matter what. They have to. So the question becomes, how does an organization of a certain size suddenly go from helping 30,000 U.S. companies export X dollars to 200 or 300 or 500,000 U.S. companies export many more times that amount of goods and services overseas? And so that requires us to not only continue what we do now, but also provide a plethora of new services to this vast, huge new customer base. And we have to figure out how to do that without any big increase in resources. So then the third part is actually then building the platform that will allow us to do that. And, you know, sometimes I refer to it as the product and service delivery platform of the future. But we're an organization that really competes on the basis of market intimacy. With people in over 200 countries, analysts watching every day, different industries and different industry sectors, offices in every state and territory of the country, we know our U.S. companies and we know the markets they sell into at a very in-depth level. Most of the services we provide are not just data, but actually these value-added, high-touch type of services. In the future, we'll be providing not only those high-touch services, which are always going to be necessary because you can't sell a nuclear power plant, you know, via Amazon, but somehow you also have to support all the small, medium-sized enterprises throughout the country that will be selling products via Amazon or Alibaba or wherever they sell it. And so having the ability to have a platform that allows us to deliver both those high-touch services and kind of low-touch services, but still have even the low-touch services tailored and customized for specific clients in specific markets is the trick. And that's what number three is all about. And then the fourth goal, like any good federal CIO or even like any CIO in the commercial world, is to maximize the return on net asset value for the ITA and the taxpayers that support us. So that means looking at new investments, reducing costs, and making sure that if we have a 10-year-old system that works, we keep it. If we need a new system, we buy the one that gives us the best bang for the buck.
All right, you gave us maybe a little bit heads up on some of your priorities, but I want to go back to two things you said. First of all, you said make life easier for people in the field, a set of services. You've been doing this for 30 years. When you talk about people in the field, do you mean ITA staff? Would you mean the businesses, small, large, medium, or maybe a little bit of both?
It's absolutely both, right? So to help one is to help the other. In our business today, most of our services are very much people-centric and people-driven. And so we have four people in Luanda, Angola. We have that size office in over 100 countries around the world and in over 54, well, all 54 U.S. states and territories. So they struggle with things like bandwidth. They struggle with things like when their printer breaks, there's no IT person to fix it. Things that you take for granted when you work in a big office in D.C. become very difficult when you work in a small office somewhere in Africa or Asia. And so just giving them the tools they need to make their life to make it more productive so they can actually do their work faster and easier as opposed to having downtime and hindrances caused by lack of good IT support.
I've had similar conversations with CIOs, for instance, at the Peace Corps, or CIOs that have, like the State Department is another good example, where they have people in remote parts of the world, and they have people in remote parts of the U.S., and they have a ton of people at headquarters, and they have to find that right balance to say, how does this service work when they have a T1 or 10 gigabit line coming in, and how do they do it when they're on Wi-Fi that goes in and out every, 3 hours? That, I imagine, is one of your biggest challenges as the CIO, is to find that right balance.
It is, but this is where I have an advantage, because I'm a commercial organization. I'm a commercial CIO sitting in a government organization that really operates like a business. We're getting out of the IT business. The ITA will be out of the IT business by the end of this calendar year. So the easiest and the best way for any government agency to deal with that is we're going to all your quadrant, your upper right Gartner quadrant, world-class service providers. So instead of us building a customer relationship management system, we're using Salesforce. Instead of us owning and operating an email system, we're going to use Office 365. Instead of us owning and operating a network, we're outsourcing our entire network to one of the big networking companies. We no longer buy printers, we no longer buy desktop computers, we no longer buy servers, we no longer buy routers. We're getting completely out of the IT business. And to me, that's how you solve that problem, right? You let industry solve it, because the federal government is only supposed to step in where the market fails. The market certainly has not failed when it comes to delivering email or collaboration services or CRM or any of those things, so there's no reason for me to get involved. I need to rely on world-class providers and set up the mechanisms that allow our customers to get those directly from them.
I definitely want to go back to that, because that's a bold statement, getting out of the IT business by the end of the calendar year. But before I do that, I think one other thing you said during, when you're going through four major thrusts that really fits in here, is you talked about, I'm the chief enterprise architect to facilitate discussion and identify, and I think this is key, business processes, not technology. You didn't say, I want to identify what's the latest, greatest technology, what mobile device, but business processes. And I think that's, to me, how you're getting out of the IT business, is because your focus as a CIO will be on the business, where I'm just seeing this huge trend happening across all of government that very similar.
Well, absolutely. I mean, so the commercial world's been there a long time, right? I mean, what's the CIO's job? The CIO's job is to make sure the company makes money, right? His bonus or her bonus is based on options and share price. So from my perspective, where the CIO has both an advantage and a disadvantage, I will never understand the intricacies of international trade the way some of my teammates do. Nor should I. I mean, they have PhDs in economics. Some of them have been working in embassies for 20 years. That's a disadvantage. But the big advantage I have is I can get them all in a room. They can all come from their different parts of the globe with their different perspectives. And I can facilitate a discussion amongst them that leads to a lot of sharing of knowledge and the development of integrated processes that aren't just focused on one of our business units, but are focused on all of our business units. And actually even driving that outside of the ITA, across commerce, across the Trade Promotion Coordinating Council, across the National Economic Council, to actually get to the point where we as a government in this space operate as a government. When I go out in the field, right, it's not about Team ITA, it's about Team USA. And so the big role of a good CIO is to actually work with the business and help the business get together and facilitate those conversations that lead to these new business processes that span across organizational boundaries. And the other advantage I have in making that happen is, A, I don't have any of these vested interests, but B, I can force it by saying, I'm not going to buy a new system until we get this done, which by law is what all CIOs are supposed to do.
Very cool. And then we're almost, I want to take a quick break before we do that. Just real quick, the makeup of your office, how many federal employees you have, contractors, and your IT budget.
So we're a very small shop, right? We have about 150 people total. About 40 of those are government. Our total budget, interesting, I'm trying to get a grip on it, but I think it's probably close to about $50 million a year for IT, which, again, tiny by federal standards, right? But that's what makes this job so great. You know, I left a couple of big organizations, and you can't do the kind of things I want to do if you have 300,000 people and this stodgy bureaucracy that won't move forward, right? When you come to a place that is small and agile and operates like a business, you can just do things much faster, much more aggressively, and in the process, kind of set the template for the rest of the federal government to follow, right? We can do things quickly, and if we do them right, it'll be easy for these big, stodgy organizations to then see it works and fall in on the example we set.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about how you're going to make those changes. My guest today is Joe Paiva, the Chief Information Officer of the International Trade Administration. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller, your host. My guest today is Joe Paiva, the CIO of the International Trade Administration. Now, Joe, before break, you talked a lot about your philosophy, if you will, your four major thrusts, and you gave us, I think, a little bit of a heads up on a couple of your big priorities. One of them was the business platform, you know, product and service delivery. The other one was, which is where I want to start this part of the conversation, is getting out of the IT business by the end of the calendar year. You hear CIOs say that. Very few ever really accomplish that. Give me a sense, how are you going to get that done?
Yeah, so it's very important to me because it goes to goal number one, which is making people more productive and making life better, quite frankly, now for our people. So we have these bundles of services that we're going to contract with. And so the first one is what I call a core infrastructure as a service. Today, if you look at the way you get devices in most government agencies, right, you order a device, you get the device, someone in the agency configures it, maybe a contractor, maybe government, doesn't matter, and then they come out and they give it to you and all that kind of stuff. The model we're contracting out for is I'm providing the major carriers a list of here are our 200 offices, the number of people, and the number of types of devices at each place, right? So you have a certain number of smartphones, a certain number of tablets, and a certain number of like Windows-based tablets. And those are the only devices we have. And I'm going to these carriers and saying, look, there is no more ITA network. And I don't care if you get bandwidth to these people by smoke signal or mirrors and people standing on rooftops. Your job is to make sure each of these people have sufficient bandwidth. And now instead of getting devices from me, they're going to go to a single portal that we have from a cloud provider, right? We use ServiceNow, but they're going to go to the single service portal. And when they join us, they come in and they say, I need a tablet and a smartphone. On the back end, their supervisor approves it. The carrier will drop ship that device directly to their location, completely figured and ready to go. I'm not involved. That person working out in the field, until their connectivity gets all the way back to either Amazon or Salesforce or Office 365, there's no government involvement in that. They're working just the way you would. Like, when was the last time you had a problem with your smartphone, your personal smartphone from whatever carrier you have it, right? It just works. That's how it needs to be for our people. So we're getting out of the network business entirely and out of the end user device business entirely. And the amount of increase in security and the decrease in cost and the better user experience and service we're going to get out of that is going to be amazing. The second thing we're doing has to do with printers. Because we're so spread out, you know, if you're in an office with four people and you have two printers and they're both broken, and the president of the United States is planning a trip and or the secretary is going to be there in 2 weeks, that's really bad, right? And because we're a U.S. government agency, the way networks are set up today in the old model where the government has a network, you can't have local support in that office come in and just do whatever they want on the printer. So we're setting up a separate network just for printers, completely public. And we're not really setting up. It's part of this carrier contract that I just mentioned. But there'll be a network that is just for printers, no attachment to the government whatsoever. We're going out with an agreement by which one of the big companies will put printers in each of those offices. Our people, when they print, whether it's from an iPad or a Windows tablet, they hit print, it goes to a print queue. They will go to any printer anywhere in the ITA, and someday maybe even anywhere in commerce. They'll swipe their proximity card and get their print job. I'm not buying the printer. I'm not maintaining the printer. I'm not leasing it. I'm not paying for a management contract, nothing. I pay, you know, a very small amount of dollars per month per user and so many cents per page, and that's it. I don't care. You know, how the contractor does it is their business. So that's our second big bundle. Our third one is Office 365. You know, the contract, like in many organizations, we had an Office 365 contract before I got here. But like most government organizations, we weren't taking full advantage of it. So people are doing things like, well, the only way you can get to Office 365 is go through a VPN, or we're going to set up Citrix to get to Office 365. And oh, we have Office 365, but we're still using this other VTC system. or we still have SharePoint hosted within our organization. So one of the first things I did is I said, wait, stop. You know, we've paid Microsoft for all that. We're done. So come back and tell me how quick you're going to shut down our SharePoint servers and get that stuff on 365. You know, we were paying, I don't want to tell you how much money, but we pay a lot of money just to have people babysit VTC systems, right? Video teleconferencing systems. Office 365 includes that. And we've been paying for it for a year and a half. So we're going to go out and get the USB microphones that people need, and they're going to use Office 365 for those types of collaborations. So the government won't have anything to do with it. And then it just goes down the line, whether we're talking about ServiceNow for ITSM or Amazon Web Services for those things that are still legacy systems that we haven't yet transitioned to a software as a service provider. That's on the infrastructure side how we're going to get out of the IT business.
Let me jump in there, because there's a few things that I definitely want to follow up with you on. The first thing you mentioned, which I think is important to talk about, is the core infrastructure as a service. So no matter where the person's located or the office is located, they're going to have access to the bandwidth they need. So you're going to have more than one carrier on that contract, or will you have more than one carrier on the contract?
So we don't know yet, but we're hoping that we have a contract with one carrier. And, you know, we're in 200 countries, right? The idea of, or 100 and something countries in 200 offices. The idea of me negotiating in Angola and Tanzania and Eritrea and Ethiopia different wireless contracts like we do today is crazy. When you think about the fact that the major carriers already have relationships, otherwise you wouldn't have international roaming. So there's really no reason why we can't get all of this from a single carrier, and that's kind of what we're hoping for.
So just by the way you're discussing this, it sounds like this decision hasn't been made yet, so there's potentially an RFP coming out. Is there any kind of acquisition? I know this sometimes can get a little sensitive, but just to give people kind of a sense.
No. So the way I try to avoid acquisition-sensitive stuff is I put everything out there in the public space, right? So if everybody knows everything, then nothing's a secret. Clearly, there is an RFI going out, and there will be an RFP, and we will do everything as much as we can with the fullest and openest competition. We'll do industry days, and we'll invite industry in to hear this stuff and know what we're doing, and we publish our plans. You know, for me, here's what it comes down to. It does not pass the reasonable person test to believe any federal organization can do networks as good as Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, or T-Mobile, can do data centers as good as Amazon or Salesforce or Microsoft or Google. To think we can do email as good as Microsoft or Google, that's insane, right? It doesn't even make sense at any level. So we just have to be open to using those industry, you know, services, and that's where we plan to go.
Is there a timing around this initial RFI, RFP that you can talk to later this year, later this summer?
Later this quarter.
All right, something to look forward to. The other thing you said that I thought was very interesting regarding infrastructure as a service is the amount of increase in security that you will get and the decrease in costs will be amazing. Talk a little bit about that, because I think one of the things that stops a lot of agencies from going in this direction is that concern about security and whether the costs really will be less or will they end up paying more. When you're doing your business case analysis and you're going through this, how did you come to that conclusion that, yes, we will get better security and pay less money?
So I have an advantage. When I was the acting director of infrastructure and then the deputy director of infrastructure and NetOps at DOD, I had all the best minds in the world come together to kind of work some of these issues and develop the core of the design that we're now implementing. And while we couldn't get there as fast as we wanted to in DOD because it's so big, that design is still where I move towards, and it's based on this. Government agencies today and a lot of big commercial companies live under this old model of warfare that says, I'm going to create the Maginot Line, right? I'm going to build this huge trench, and everything inside the trench is safe, and I'm just going to have, you know, concentric circles of trenches, and that's how I'm going to defend myself, right? No one's fought wars like that since, like, before Korea. And the reason they don't do that is because the Germans prove that once you break the line, you go crazy inside and you lose. And inevitably, if you look at all the hacks of any system, commercial or government, it's always the same thing, right? Someone sends a spear phishing message or however they do it. They compromise a single user device and then they move laterally across the network until they get to the crown jewels, right? It's always the same thing. And it's silly. So this is where it comes to understanding the business, you know, goal number two. If you can really work with the business to understand what's important, and if you can use world-class providers like Microsoft, Salesforce, whoever, to be your cloud provider of those mission applications, then what you do is you say, you know what? I know end-user devices are eventually going to get compromised. I know that if I'm on a cellular network overseas, it's compromised. Heck, places in the U.S., it's compromised. So I accept that that's compromised. So instead of living with this false sense of security of I'm guarding my network and no one can get in, when they always do, right? Just put the important stuff in the cloud, use data at rest encryption to encrypt it, make sure you know who controls the keys and how they're controlled, and then accept that the network can't be secured. Accept that the end user device can't be secured. And now what you do is you just, remember Maxwell Smart, the cone of silence? Well, think about your service provider, whether it's Salesforce or ServiceNow or Microsoft, Google. And at the time you go to use it, there's this little kind of tentacle that comes out, this little cone of silence that comes out. And on the device, you're operating in that cone of silence, going back to that provider. And you don't care that the network is compromised. You don't care. I mean, you don't want the device to be compromised. But if it is, you're not losing the crown jewels, right? Because you're not allowing lateral movement. You're not allowing access to everything from one place.
The cone of silence. We will, on that note, we will take a quick break. My guest today is Joe Paiva, the International Trade Administration's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Joe Paiva, the International Trade Administration's Chief Information Officer. Now, Joe, before break, you're describing how you guys are going to move away from IT in many regards, in the sense of owning it and operating it. It's almost a total outsourced model. The old seat management approach almost comes to mind. One of the other things you brought up was printing and saying we're going to have a separate print network that we're going to basically outsource. But then you also mentioned GPO and GSA. Now, I know GSA, for instance, has a strategic sourcing around print management. GPO provides a set of services. Are those the services you're looking at, or how does GSA and GPO fit in?
So the services we're looking at are offered and in use by all those major companies with their commercial customers. What most government agencies do today is if you look at the GSA schedule, you go to GPOs, when they talk about managed print, because they have that old network model, they're talking about the government buying or leasing the printers, putting them on the government's network, and then buying the print management server application and putting it on a government server and running it internally. What we're doing that's very, very different is because none of the printers are on our network, we're going out to the cloud provider. So even though all those companies on the GSA schedule have a cloud service that they offer to their commercial customers, no government agencies have asked them for it yet. None have been FedRAMP approved yet. So we're working with GPO, who leverages, I believe, the GSA contractual vehicles, right, to actually work on this solicitation package and get this out to where it will leverage a lot of those same technologies, but delivered in a very different manner, because we have this 21st century style of network that other government agencies don't yet have, right? If you think of the print management servers that people buy and install in their networks, and then you think of software as a service, we're just getting it software as a service. And there's a lot of good things about that, right? Because now I can print from any device to any printer from anywhere without going through a VPN or Citrix or being on a network or any of that kind of stuff.
So it's interesting because you talk about getting FedRAMP approved printer service in the cloud. Are you guys ushering or at least working with a series of vendors to get FedRAMP approved? Or is that something that GPO is doing through the GSA contracts? Do you have enough familiarity with that?
Well, whenever vendors come and they meet with us, we're in the market research phase, right? And we're just now doing proofs of concept and that sort of thing. And when I meet with vendors, I'm very upfront with them about, you know, eventually to get beyond proof of concept, you know, you're going to have to do the things it would take to be FedRAMP approved. To me, I don't care a lot about FedRAMP. I think it has some good guidelines and it's always a plus if you are. But I think more I look at things on their own merit. So when you talk about a managed print service, you actually have documents that are in the cloud. So FedRAMP would say they have to be FIPS 140 encrypted. I would agree with that, but I look at it differently and say, I care more about who has the keys. So as opposed to the print provider doing FIPS 140 protection, I'm looking at a model where I would use an encryption gateway service, and then I can use whatever SaaS provider I want. The SaaS provider has no access to my documents, ever. In this model, right? Because I'm going through an encryption gateway that will encrypt the document, so all they see is an encrypted payload passing through their system. So there are things like that that will work out with the vendors as they respond to the GSA, GPO, RFIs, we're bound by government policy to go through GPO. And we would do that anyway because they have the expertise in this field, right? So I may have a great vision, but they have the detailed knowledge, right? And so we're counting on them to kind of point out the landmines to make sure we don't step in it. And so that's how we're working that.
Let's move over. We talked a lot about some of the, if you will, back office side. You talked to us about mission earlier on. What are some priorities within the mission part of ITA?
So from a mission perspective, we're kind of taking the same approach. I want to get us out of the IT business. So part of that is working with my business partners to understand their business and then be able to draw the parallels between that and what happens in Fortune 500 commercial companies. And that allows us to get past the government-coded solution answer that a lot of bigger organizations kind of default to and go to the SaaS first. So my number one priority right now is customer relationship management. I mean, we are a customer-focused, customer-driven organization, and CRM is incredibly important to us. There was a full and open process last year. It started before I got here. We awarded a contract to Salesforce.com, and we're rolling out Salesforce globally as I speak. I mean, we're actually opening up the sandbox this month, and we'll cut everyone over in June. All these things I mentioned have tight time frames because you have to, right? I hate SESs who have five-year plans and spend 2 years in a job. So all these things are going to get done within this year. So CRM with Salesforce is the first. The second one is, you know, you might not know this, but ITA actually has the equivalent of our own law firm plus our own judicial system all within the organization, right? We don't have the executioners, but we kind of have the judge, the jury, the police, the investigators. But they operate like a big legal firm. And so we're looking at software as a service providers in the law firm legal practice world to provide a best-in-class, you know, world-class solution to how to manage the business of legal case management as you would if you were a lawyer or a private investigator. And then the third thing we do is I mentioned before that some organizations are in the data business. We're in the value-added information business. And so what that means is when we think about big data, where some organizations, a lot of organizations traditionally, can spend 80% of their effort cleaning up and normalizing data and creating models, right? And then they spend 20% of their time doing actual hardcore value-added analysis because that's all that's left after they spent the 80% building the models and cleaning up the data. There are now lots of commercial software as a service providers out there that can actually do that normalization, do that data cleansing, and actually even create very complex models with minimal to no human intervention. So you look at healthcare, right? I mean, they're big into this in healthcare. Healthcare's managed to get in front of the economic folks, at least in the government side, right? But if you look at people that make money in Wall Street, right? They're making money doing arbitrage. If you don't think they have some really great models that drive that whole arbitrage way, I mean, I think there was an article in The Economist recently about, you know, the top of the top. That's all they do is build these models and do arbitrage. So we are going to outsource a world-class provider for a software as a service that will basically take in all this data, normalize it, and create models that then will free up our economists' time to actually do more value-added analysis and provide our customers more value-added information products in a more productive and efficient and effective way. And so that's a big piece for us. That will also drive knowledge management across the enterprise. So one of our very large priorities that kind of drives through all of this is we're on this big data atomization effort. And so what I mean by data atomization is we're getting out of the business of creating big documents and getting into the business of collecting atoms of data. And each atom of data will have a standardized set of metadata attached to it. So today, if you go to our website, if you want to sell electric canoes in Asia, you would have to search pleasure craft, you know, marine pleasure craft or personal watercraft for Asia, and you would get a report for every country and then some other industry reports, and you'd have to look through and search through to get the nuggets you really wanted in the countries that you wanted. If we had all that data atomized, Instead, that report would self-generate and would just have the information you want. It would just have personal watercraft or pleasure craft in those countries that actually had opportunities. You wouldn't have to sort through as much information to get to that. It's almost like when Google talks about mass customization. Our data atomization effort is all about our ability to provide value-added information services through this concept of mass customization.
You're talking about to do a lot with data, and you're looking at companies to help you. Are you also looking internally? Because working with the business folks to say what data is most important, what data taxonomies or standards you have to really apply, are you looking to bring in, for instance, data scientists or others that have that type of skill? Or again, you're going to, because you're outsourcing so much of this out, you're going to depend on the vendors to really provide that expertise in the sense of how something gets done, not necessarily the what, because that's, again, I think a business function.
No, this is definitely a place where the vendors can't do it. The vendors can provide the platform, so we're not spending 80% of our time doing the plumbing, but the business has all the expertise. So there's a guy, Dr. Tibbetts at the VA, who has this model of a lockdown. We actually are using that model to go through this 2+ month process by which we're bringing in the business in a series of meetings to actually have the business lead and drive that discussion where we simply act as the facilitator. And I think that's the role of a good CIO, right? Is to facilitate those discussions. But when we get through the end of that process in around the March timeframe, we'll actually have these standard metadata tags. And then it will be a continuous process where we also have another group under a woman named Lisa Wolfish here in ITA. And at the department level, there's a couple people working on it who are looking at how do we maximize customer user experience. And so we take those inputs and we kind of merge them, the people telling us what the user experience requirements are, both internally and externally, and those internal data scientists, economists, business people really telling us what needs to happen. They're the real drivers of this, right? We're simply the facilitators of that activity.
Very good. I think, again, so much going on, a lot to watch for. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. I'm sure there's a little more to talk about. My guest today is Joe Paiva, the CIO of the International Trade Administration. I'm Jason Miller, your host, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is Joe Paiva, the International Trade Administration's Chief Information Officer. Now, Joe, we've talked a lot about your plans, your priorities. You have a ton to get done over the next year. One thing that comes to mind as you kind of describe the moves to the cloud, the almost full outsourcing of the IT operations piece, is commerce. Talking to your former CIO, Simone Zickman, and several of the bureau-level CIOs over the years, you guys at Commerce, generally speaking, have been looking at enterprise services, shared services, you know, where one of the bureaus will handle the main piece of that back office system for everybody else. How does your plans fit into everything that's going on around commerce? And where does innovation fit in that discussion as well?
So the ITA is strategically positioned within commerce, not just because we're the biggest entity here in the headquarters building, but because if you think about the way commerce is set up, there's the big bureaus, the little bureaus, and then there's us, the middle child. So we're big enough to actually prove things work, but small enough to actually be agile and lead from in front. And so as I go down this path and we start working on these kind of new approaches to doing things, I'm making sure that we write these contracts in a way that the rest of commerce can use. And that's important because we have this incredible focus on developing shared services throughout the department. And there's two reasons for that. One is obviously to save the taxpayers money, but the other is because our customers aren't ITA customers. They're US government customers. The services our customers need can't just be provided by ITA. We need the rest of commerce. For matter of fact, we need the rest of the TPCC, and we need the rest of the National Economics Council people. So when you think about how we affect our customers, we are part of a team, and so we need to operate as part of that team, whether it's with State Department or the Small Business Administration or the Minority Business Development Agency or Census, NIST, all of them. So inside and outside of commerce. So shared services just really make sense. The flip side of that is the old model of shared services, the model that I've seen fail miserably at other federal departments, is where you say, we're going to start centralizing this, or we're going to start having this one organization do this for everybody. There are certain things that the government just should not do. So when I talk about getting ITA out of the IT business, what I hope I'm doing is leading from in front and helping the Department of Commerce get out of the IT business. And when I talk to my fellow CIOs in the Department of Commerce, we are, by and large, of the same mind, right? I haven't met a fellow CIO in commerce yet that wants to run their own email system, that wants to run their own SharePoint servers, right? They're all coming from the same place I am, right? They want to have world-class providers provide these services so they can focus on the things that really matter to their particular administrations, to their particular customers. So I think what we're doing folds in nicely with the broader Department of Commerce effort to implement shared services. But I don't think those shared services equal this group does it. I envision a shared services organization for IT in the Department of Commerce that's a room full of COTARs managing a handful or maybe a dozen indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, where if Zach or Dell want email, they order it off the same contract the way I do. If they want printing, they get it from the same contract I do. If they want cell phones, they get it from the same contract I do. But we're not counting on some organization full of government people or government-managed contractors to do that. We're counting on an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract where some world-class provider will provide those services.
One key piece of where you, when you talk about where you guys are heading, is definitely the workforce. And one thing about the workforce is you said a room full of COTARs who can, you know, kind of look at IDIQ contracts and make decisions that way. There's a big training piece to all of this. We talked a little bit about the data people, the business world, the business mission areas have to have the data scientists to understand the data, to how to meta tag them. What are you doing to ensure that your workforce is up to the task of everything you're asking them to do? Because again, the other thing you said was short time, got to get a lot done.
I'll put it in kind of three parts. One is you have to convince all these IT specialists that to be a good CIO isn't about the technology, it's about the business. So I've reached out to some of my partners on the operating units of ITA, and they've been very gracious, very generous with their time and their people's time to actually set up a training program to train our IT people in the art of trade, tradecraft as we call it, right? They're actually training me and training the people who work for me to know and understand our business. So that's one thing, is train the people you have to not just be tech-focused, but to be business focused and by that really understand their customers and their customers' needs. The second part of this is changing the force structure. So like a lot of government agencies, we got ourselves into this place where we're so leveraged with contractors that I don't have any GS7s, 9s, 11s, 12s on my staff, right? Everything shoots straight up. I mean, you start at a 13 and then you go to 15 and then you're an SES, right? So we don't have a farm team. I mean, where would the Yankees be without like a farm team, right? It would never work. So in addition to training my people in the business, we're restructuring the organization to have a lot more ladder positions. And the HR folks have been very helpful with me in trying to figure out how do we establish these 7, 9, 11, 12 positions where you can hire people and have them grow within the organization. And then you grow them the way they need to be so they understand both tradecraft and technology and they're business focused. And they have a future where you can actually groom them and build their skills while they're here, right? So that's the second part. The third part is I'm actually setting up a program where we can bring in local talent. So if you look at the DC public schools, they have a program in place that has this, they call it like the National Academies, but essentially they have schools where they take local kids and they start teaching them IT while they're still in high school. I'm looking at different ways to get those kids in here working and be able to take them and grow them from being high school juniors to being graduates of UDC or Howard or Harvard or Tufts, right? And have them actually have a path forward that includes an element of public service, right? But grow that workforce from the beginning, which is a win-win for the taxpayer because let's face it, our contracts today and our labor categories today for our government employees, do you really need a 4-year degree and 8 years of experience to write JavaScript? I think there's this misperception of how we value people, right? We value people by the letters after their name instead of by, you know, the words they say and, you know, the burning desire they have to support the mission. So I think we kind of changed that by building in these ladder positions, reaching out to the local school system to bring people in early, and then just providing this business-focused approach to IT.
I know there's a lot more we could talk about that. We're going to have to come back and do that another time. We're almost out of time. You talked a lot about the RFIs, RFPs, a lot of opportunities that are coming up for vendors. What should they know about working with your office?
So a couple things. One is I'm going to borrow the method that the VA uses in terms of we're going to schedule some big vendor days and invite people in to understand where our path are. The other thing is sales pitches don't interest me, right? If you come to see me and you don't have a hardcore sales engineer that can talk tech, and if you're not ready to demo something, PowerPoints leave me feeling empty. The other thing is, if they're coming here, they really need to be talking about what they do in the commercial world. I'm a lot more interested in their Fortune 500 customers than I am in necessarily other government agencies, because I want to skate to where the puck is, not where the puck was. That's it.
All right, two good quotes, cone of silence, PowerPoints leave me empty. Joe Paiva has been my guest today. He's the International Trade Administration within the Department of Commerce, Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller. You've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick.